Hello, assalamu alaikum. I'm coming from Lahore University of Management Sciences, which has initiated the School of Science and Engineering. And first of all, I would like to thank Vinay for giving me a lifetime opportunity to come to India for the first time and give a talk, present my work among such distinguished people like Matt gave a talk and Mahan wants to give a talk. And the session is like, when I was coming here, I was thinking, how am I going to explain people more epigenetic assimilation or genetic assimilation and then make it to chromatin DNA methylation? But I think the stage is set by both the previous speakers such nicely that I feel really confident that I can go through. Vidya, thank you very much. We have greetings from Shahid. Email exchange yesterday. And Vidya was actually extremely helpful together with Dr. Rahul, our host here. And I would like to thank not only these two people who really got us here, but all the people I'm coming across this room, beyond this room, even in Delhi, everywhere. It's really a, like a, I was full of anxiety when I was getting into flight. I don't know what's going to happen, you know, I have to go to police station, blah, blah, blah. But everything is gone when I met, you know, such lovely people. You're just great people, you're just like second home to me. So, let's start. So I would just like to, because it's such a multidisciplinary audience here, I would just like to start from very, very basic and slowly build up, because it will get complicated because I have a lot of data in the end. So the jargon we are using in this meeting, everybody is hearing me at the back? I think I'm loud enough. So we are using genetic and epigenetic, and as the title you saw, says molecular basis of epigenetic variation as a source of acquired traits. And I leave a question mark in the end because I'm not going to claim that whatever I'm saying is true. I'm not going to give you a definite answer. Rather, I'm going to give you just food for thought. So genetic, in a classic terms, you have, when you have a change in DNA sequence like this specific nucleotide is changed from A to G, and if the protein function is affected, so this is called a classic genetic mutation, and the organism would be called a mutant, and if this gene loses its function and leads to a phenotype, that would be called a genetic mutant or a genetic phenotype. In contrast, the epigenetics is basically the DNA sequence, the basic gene sequence stays the same. There's no change in the primary nucleotide of the sequence. But what happens, something like these lollipops, which we call DNA methylation or histone methylation, whatever, you know, a chemical modification of the chromatin comes, and that disrupts the gene function. So such type of organism we name, and disruption of the gene function, this is like that. Let's say gene was active, which means messenger RNA was being made, protein was being made. If that is finished, so then this organism would be called, we normally refer to them as epimutants. So in this case, you have basically intact gene, but something above the level of DNA has happened, which is blocking the gene function. So this is when I'll be using genetic and epigenetic repeatedly. So this is what I would be referring. So my talk is basically how epigenetics or how the environmental impact, how the environmental sensory machinery or the homeostasis machinery in our cells interacts with the environment and then leads to the integration of that environmental signal into the genome. So that's the whole philosophy of the talk or the outline of the talk. So I have three pictures here which is very much redundant with all the previous talks. So like this is a monozygotic twin. So these two are same, and now there is a very established study which tells us that even the monozygotic twins which have same genetic info, they develop differently because, you know, their behavior, the way they interact, their epigenome is different, or the epigenetic makeup is different. This picture was shown by Patrick as well. So this is like, these are siblings. This one is coming from a mother which was fed folic acid during pregnancy, and basically there's a transposon which gets active. So due to folic acid contains a methyl donor which causes the DNA methylation on the transposon, and that transposon leads to silencing of a gene which is downstream. What happens, the gene which gives the fur color and the obesity, that is kept silent in the wild type. But when that donor is missing, you see, you have these obese mice and fur color is changed. And this is a pure epigenetic. is showing the exact. This is another very classic example, Carlos Linnaeus, the guy who, you know, described all different species of the plants. So this is snapdragon, this is bilateral symmetry, and this is a radial symmetry. So he left this out of his classification, naming it as a dragon plant, because he couldn't really figure out where does it fit in. And now we know that the difference between this and this is the radial symmetry, this is basically the same plant, but the gene called Cyclertia, it contains DNA methylation in the promoter region, which led to the change of the symmetry. So people who are asking about, you know, environment-regulated examples of the, you know, epigenome, so these are already covered. And this is one of, this was published in Nature 2000, I believe. So phenotypic plasticity has been introduced in the morning. I just thought, so these are three different examples. For example, this tadpole, this responds to the predator in the pond. So when it sees a predator, it changes its phenotype, so red color, and muscles get stronger. Whenever a predator is on, it goes back to the normal phenotype. I like to talk about this one as well. So this is a caterpillar. So this phenotypic change, this is the same caterpillar. This phenotypic change is basically caused by nutrition. So for example, the catkin flowers in the spring, when the caterpillar feeds on the catkin flowers, you see it just hides the camouflage, gets camouflaged in these catkin flowers. In summer, when there are no more catkin flowers, you see it just looks like a twig. Another example of the phenotypic plasticity is, this is amazing to myself as well, so these fish, this blue-headed fish, so they are in cluster, they grow like in a cluster, so fish cluster is called, I think, school. And there's only just one male. There's just one male. If a new fish will come in and wants to enter, so if he sees there is a male already, it will stay as female. As soon as a male will die, one of the female from the school, it will change its phenotype within one day, and it will become a female, will turn into a male. So that's like a, these are classic examples of the phenotypic plasticity in response to environment. So here, we don't have any genetic change, for example. But the next example I have here is, these are the Siamese cat and the Himalayan rabbit. Basically, these regions of the ears, these are the...
So in this latest example, out of those, I mean, females in this school, only one gets a chance of becoming a male.
Yeah.
What factor affects here, actually? Why would they, is there any competition among those females?
Nobody knows. Molecular basis is not known. So this Siamese cat, so this basically contains a genetic variant in a tyrosine kinase. And in this region of the body where the body temperature is normally warm, so this does not really work properly, but where the cooler region of the body are, this enzyme can work and the melanin synthetic pathway is functional. So this is like a perfect example of now a genetic variation. So you have a genetic variation within the organism, but in this environment where temperature is more, this protein not maybe folds properly and does not do proper function, so you don't have melanin as much as you have in the ears. This example of the locust, this is basically, there's not a genetic variation here, this is just called crowding effect.
What you have shared, that could be a specially regulated spatiotemporal regulation of the gene.
No.
Qualify as.
Because they have done the in vitro studies as well, so just in the, by raising the temperature, at different temperature, protein folds improperly and protein folds properly at low temperature. But spatial temporal regulation is very different then. So this is like, this response to this kinase, tyrosinase, this responds very specifically in this region and does a proper function in melanin pathways because of the temperature. So this is a crowding effect. Another example. So we covered temperature, we saw nutrition, we saw you know, the male and conversion of a female into male. This is a crowding effect. So locusts, when they are crowded, they develop this phenotype, and this is transgenerational. It can go from one generation to the next, so generation after generation. So when we talk about phenotypic plasticity, we have to keep in mind that some changes are transient, like this first example I showed you, predator comes in and the tadpole changes its body color. Some changes are long term, which we call transgenerational, like once it is there, then it's passed on from generation to generation. And in this case, they have found that if you take the foam from the oviposition when it lays the egg, foam around the egg and put it around the egg which is laid by this, you convert basically this generation to this, and then that's fixed for generations to come. So all these are basically examples of the phenotypic plasticity. All these are examples of the our genome or the epigenome, whatever is there, it does interact directly with the environment. So this is how in latest reviews, or some of the reviews which are appearing nowadays, they put what originally Waddington basically said, that if you have a phenotype, you change the environment, you develop a different phenotype, and this phenotype has the potential to get fixed, which he referred to as assimilation. So this was what I read about Waddington, that genotype, it does interact with the environment to give a specific phenotype in living organisms. I'm sorry I have to go through canalization and assimilation. You have heard all this in the morning, but this is what the stage will set into the subject I'm entering. So what Waddington explained, canalization, buffering, or robustness, all these things are more or less the same, because what it described, that we all have genetic variation, all the humans have genetic variation, we all live in a different environment, but we all develop to a definite developmental end, our all phenotype is same. Like I was reading Patrick's abstract in the book, and it was very nicely written that nobody would ever confuse a human with a chimp, because we are designed, we are programmed to develop to a definite phenotype. And the buffer to keep all this genetic variation or whatever is inside our genomes different from each other is basically referred to as a canalization. There is a specific mechanism. We don't know what are those canalization or the buffering factors are. We'll shortly talk about it. So these are the figures from Waddington's paper. I came across them in 2002 when I joined Renato Pardo's lab in Heidelberg. And it, trust me, it took me a couple of days to read this paper again and again, because I was moving from classic chromatin to an area which was different. So this is canalization, because this is, for example, your starting point as a growing embryo. And you, during development, take different developmental routes. If you talk about just one single organism is developing, so different cell lineages will start. So canalization is basically from these canals which are there. And Waddington very nicely proposed that these canals are basically controlled by these PEGs. PEGs we can assume as genes or the gene products, which are the proteins. So these canals are basically controlled by underlying, you know, protein networks or the genetic networks. And this is like what nowadays we are trying to talk about, the systems biology. So this is more or less a systems biology picture he drew like 60 years ago. He also went on to suggest that basically all this is a result of the natural selection.
But all those canals have the same nodal gene?
No, there will be different genetic networks. There will be different. So let's say if I have eye development.
What is the one on the top? What is that?
This one? So this is like a fertilized embryo, which is going to start its path. Then different cells will be formed, and they will go into different, you know, lineages, different canals. So the basis of his theory was this particular experiment, which Mahadev already talked about. So what he did, he took a Drosophila larvae, and he heat shocked it for 13 to 14 generations at third instar larvae. And after 13 to 14 generations, he stopped giving heat shock. What he saw this cross vein, the phenotype. So the vein between two different veins, that was broken. After 13 to 14 generations, what he saw, that this phenotype got fixed. It was not dependent on the initial inducer, which was the heat shock. This stage, when he was giving heat shock, he referred to as assimilation, when phenotype is being incorporated into the genome. And the stage when it has become fixed, this is referred to as canalization. As Mahadev already talked about, so from what Inton to 1998, when Lindquist lab did these studies using HSP90, they found that HSP90 does behave something like a canalization factor. You get HSP90 mutation, or without mutating, if you just give heat shock, which means you are inhibiting the HSP90 function, or if you inhibit HSP90 just by drug, you develop these phenotypes, phenocopies. So in fly, and you don't see all the flies, you always see 3 to 4% of the flies. Rest of 97 to 98% of the flies, they are going normally. You see only 3 to 4% of the flies showing this phenotype. They reproduce this study in Arabidopsis just by using drug inhibitor, and both of these papers came in, I believe, in Nature by Quintus and the Rutherford. What was most interesting to me was these phenotypes. When I was moving from plants, doing my PhD in Arabidopsis, I was moving into Drosophila, and reading this paper, these phenotypes were interesting because all these hortae, legs, oryx, these are different appendages in the Drosophila body. All of them were getting affected, and these phenotypes, after selection for a certain generation, these phenotypes could be fixed, just like, you know, the assimilation experiment of the whatever. So they propose that HSP90 is basically capacitor for morphological evolution. What does it mean, capacitor for morphological evolution? What it means is that you have genetic variation in your genome, and basically HSP90 is buffering or blocking the expression of that phenotypic level, but properly folded. What basically HSP90 is doing, HSP90 is a molecular chaperone. It's involved in protein folding. So this shows you a signaling network which is included as a client proteins of the HSP90. So all these blue ones, like these, so these are HSP90 targets. HSP90 has more than 100 client proteins, not targets, client proteins. What it does, it holds protein in a proper conformation which is ready to perform its function. So that's just the function of the HSP90. If we think in terms of epigenetic capacitor function, so capacitor, I always give example of, you know, the capacitor in the fan or these things which absorbs the, you know, fluctuations. So HSP90 will block all the fluctuation if there is a genetic variation in all these genes, and you will have a definite canalized phenotype, no mutant phenotype. Only it will express if you remove the function of the HSP90. When I say it, so this is how basically HSP90 cycle, chaperone cycle, we call it chaperone cycle. It works. This is a classic example of glucocorticoid receptor. So HSP90, it interacts with the glucocorticoid, this is a steroid hormone receptor. Now it keeps it like in a hold form. It holds it in readily activable form. As soon as the steroid hormone comes in, HSP90 goes away, and the receptor moves into nucleus, binds to genes, and perform its function. It goes back, it comes off the chromatin, HSP90 catches it up, and it recycles, or it goes to degradation. This is the classic, you know, chaperone cycle of the HSP90. This is how HSP90 functions. How genetic capacitor function, when I say, how it fits in all these things, you know, these examples which I'm giving. So genetic capacitor, if you consider this as a population, and these red ones are different loci, these are depicting basically genetic variation at the DNA level. Now, and they all have same phenotypes. Because they are buffered. Now, if you have stress, what happens, HSP90 function is getting compromised, and the one of the genetic variant, which is, let's say, more prone to develop a specific phenotype, you have a phenotypic variation, so a new trait comes in. And after selection, so these repeated arrows means you are selecting for a couple of generations, you can fix this phenotype. So this is the genetic capacitor function of the HSP90, which means HSP90 is buffering or canalizing all this variation in the genome. However, a contradictory study came in 2002, which was from Rudin's lab. And Shulgin showed that HSP90 may act as epigenetic capacitor. You know, that if you have an isogenic population, which does not contain any genetic variation, so HSP90 has a role to block or buffer or mask the epigenetic variation. If you remove the HSP90, you will develop similar phenotypes, rather much more stronger. So what they did, their basis of saying all this was, they took a fly line, so this is normal Drosophila eye, this is how it looks like. This is a fly line in which the Drosophila eye expresses a transcription factor which is not supposed to be there. And you develop this phenotype. They use this fly and they went to mutant screen. They did the, we call it deficiency screening. So after mutagenesis, what they wanted to see was there that what are the genes which enhance this phenotype. And what they found was these were the candidate genes, and if you look here, there were five different alleles. Five different alleles means five times HSP90 is hit in different sites within HSP90 gene. So five different genes of five different alleles could give them this phenotype. What they did was, they also saw one of the protein which is like categorized as trithorax group, and I will be just shortly introducing what trithorax group is. Trithorax group or polycomb group like protein here, and they showed that was also giving same phenotype. They could show link between HSP90 and, you know, chromatin process through showing that the histones are getting affected by HSP83 or HSP90 gene. What was most important was they isogenized this line. When I say isogenized, it means they repeatedly crossed it back cross to remove all the genetic variation. So they ensured there is no genetic variation. Now, if there is anything, it will be only epigenetic variation. And they could reproduce all these phenotypes. That was the basis of saying that the HSP90 is buffering or masking the epigenetic variation there. You remove HSP90 and these phenotypes come in. So epigenetic capacitor says you have this population, and I go one step further. Instead of this population, I say just consider it as your tissue, because your tissues, a normal tissue will have isogenized genome, you know, same genome in my skin cell. There will be no genetic variation in my skin cell or liver cell. So if this is a population or your skin cell, you have, you know, this chromosomes which does not contain any genetic variation. What happens? You get heat shock and HSP90 function gets compromised. And what, if you get a new phenotype, it means there is something above the level of DNA. And above the level of DNA, whether it is a DNA modification, whether it's a chromatin modification, this is still debatable. Our very important point here is, if you remember, Rutherford or Lindquist lab, it took them 7 generations to fix the phenotype. You know, they selected phenotype, crossed. In every generation, they were selecting phenotype and crossing to enrich, and then fixing or assimilating to reach a canalized gene. Here, you can fix the trait within 1 generation. So, because the phenotype has nothing to do with the genetic variation, you are just going to select two, you know, morphologically different, and you have the potential to fix the phenotype within 1 generation. This is what Ruthen could show in his paper, which was published in Nature Genetics in 2002.
Right. So like in the HSP90 mutations and so forth, when you give heat shock or you disturb the HSP90, you find a variety of mutant phenotypes. In this case, do you find much fewer or just one mutant phenotype?
In this case, since they had a, we call it reporter gene, which made their life easier, because, you know, instead of looking on all different mutants, they were just screening for this. But they could also show in eye imagination this, another phenotype, which basically linked to this one. So their study was basically only on the eye using as a reporter system. But I fully understand your question. You are thinking that there should be more phenotypes coming in. But I think it either may have simply excluded, because they, as a researcher, I would like to have my life more easier. Same phenotype which I can correlate with the molecular basis as well, you know, because eventually you have to correlate with the molecular basis. So this is an epigenetic capacitor. believe that HSP90 is one of the canonization factor. It's not the canonization factor, because there will be many canonization factors within our cells. These are the client proteins. What we were interested in, or what I got interested in, was HSP90 linked to polycomb and trichorex group proteins. What are polycomb and trichorex group proteins? These are basically one of the major cell fate determinants, or one of the major cellular memory factors. And now I mean, after all this HSP90 intro, I come to what cellular memory is. So we have, this is a classic neurodevelopmental module of undergrad students. So you start your life as a single cell, early during development, you have this determination of different cell types. This, once a cell fate is determined, once cell fate is determined, this cell fate is inherited throughout the, you know, the rest of the life of the organism. So the identity of this cell, let's say these are liver cells, these are heart cells, they have to be maintained throughout the life. So the cells which are liver, which were originally made liver when I was still in my mother's womb, they are still liver. And the heart cells, they have to stay like this, because if they lose their memory, we call this as memory mechanism. This is like, and this memory mechanism, which stays even after at terminal differentiation, this is maintained at the epigenetic level. And the proteins which are involved doing this function, they are called polycomb and trichorex group proteins. I'll be just introducing them. They were originally found by, or categorized by, Ed Lewis in 1960s. He also won one of the Nobel Prize the people who got him flight veteran. So this is what's happening in cellular memory. So this is a few hours old embryo, Drosophila embryo. You have, these are homeotic genes. These are the genes which are called the master regulators, which really give identity to, let's say, eye and the limbs, everything. So the color code is just the place where these genes are getting expressed. So this gene, labial, is getting expressed in the head, and so on. You see from head all the way towards tail, you have this pattern is established early during development within first few hours. And this pattern is maintained of these master regulators till the adulthood. This was found to be highly conserved in mammals as well. So for example, you have Drosophila embryo. This is the same gene cluster. The way it is being expressed from anterior to posterior, head to tail, and the mouse embryo, and this is highly conserved. As I said earlier, this is maintained as this process of cellular memory, because these cells are remembering, they are passing on generation after generation through mitosis, that these cells have to stay as most posterior cells. And this is maintained at the epigenetics. Now let me come to the epigenetics, how epigenetics is basically functioning. This is a fundamental unit of our DNA, our chromatin.
Giving the impression that this is a process that occurs at the cellular level. Each cell that this, and you are giving the impression that the environment doesn't have anything to do, in other words, where those cells end up.
Michael, there is a slide coming to work with you. So, basically, that epigenetics is basically nowadays, people have unfortunately limited the epigenetics to just DNA methylation or histomethylation, because this is a fashion nowadays. So you have 146 base pairs of DNA, you know, just like thread around the pulley. These are the histone, for histone, this octamer. This is like for one single nucleus. And both of these components of the DNA, they can get modified. For example, DNA, which is shown here, wrapped around. So if I go to the nucleotide sequence level, so you have DNA gets methylation, a covalent mark at the cytosine, and these are the contacts, CG sequence. And this is called symmetrical methylation. Both are strands, so C, and in the reverse you will have this palindrome. So if this C is methylated, this will be also maintained as methylated. This is present in both plants and mammals. This is C and G methylation, so you have N is any nucleotide. This is very plant specific. There's mammals lack this. And CNN is called asymmetric methylation because there's no symmetry in the sequence. So only one of the strands will get methylated. So this is one of the key factors which was originally described as cellular memory factor in 70s for inheritance to mitosis. Histones, on the other hand, in contrast to DNA, so this is like, let's say, histone H3, if we focus on histone H3, you have this N-terminal tail, and histones can get variety of modification. They can get methylation, they can get acetylation, phosphorylation, even sumoylation, there are many missing here. And these things, they together interact with each other, they crosstalk to each other, and they affect the gene regulation or the gene function. This is how epigenetic or epimutant functions if you change something here. How these modifications, once they are, these modifications, let's say you got DNA methylation or histone methylation, how they are inherited, we call the process epigenetic inheritance or cellular memory. So let's say you have DNA methylation, these circles are DNA methylation in CG context. This is CNG context if you're talking about plants. There is a crosstalk between DNA methylation and this is a histone methylation. So line is like a, let's imagine it as a histone. So DNA methylation will talk to histone. It will cause histone methylation, which feeds back onto histone, and you have CNG methylation. When you go through DNA replication, there are specific proteins when this DNA will undergo semi-conservative replication. So these pink strands go on the opposite side. There are specific proteins which will recognize hemimethylated state because one of the strands will be only methylated. So these proteins will methylate the newly formed strand, and this is how epigenetic modifications, they are inherited through DNA replication, through mitosis as well as meiosis in some cases. Any questions? How does polycomb and tricholic group fit in all this? Basically, polycomb and tricholic group is, if you just remember the cellular memory stuff I just talked about, at the cell fate determination, just these are different shapes are showing different type of cells. So you have these differential gene expression is being established here. And once these differential gene expression is established, these both polycomb and tricholic, so tricholic will maintain genes which needs to be active, and polycomb will maintain the genes in silent state, and they are inherited in the subsequent generations. How polycomb and tricholic does this job? The question was just asked there. So basically, during early development, you have these big heart, nerves, scruple, these like maternal genes, gap genes, parental genes, which comes transiently in early development, and then they disappear after establishing specific patterns. Once you have specific pattern established, after specific time they are born, and the job is taken up. So for example, you start with maternal genes, which are big and caudal, you come all the way to parental genes, and finally in the adult, all the amniotic genes have to maintain everything what these people initially said. And the expression of these genes are maintained by polycomb and tricholic group proteins. I hope it clarifies that. So same gene, let's talk about polycomb and tricholic. If you have a same gene which is active in flies in this part, but the same gene has to stay inactive, so this is a function, antagonistic function polycomb and tricholic does. Polycomb will maintain the gene in silent state, and tricholic will maintain it in the active state in a very specific region. How do they do this job? Is basically there are specific cis-acting DNA elements. There are like DNA elements within the genome. These proteins recognize them, they bind, they cause histone methylation, like lysine 27, histone H3 lysine 27 methylation is associated with polycomb. Histone H3 lysine 4 methylation is associated with tricholic. So now you have, I think, a clear picture of how the epigenetics is linked, or histone modification and DNA methylation are linked to polycomb tricholic. Polycomb is also linked to, in mammals, it's linked to DNA methylation. So all these are different pieces of same puzzle coming together. So this picture shows you how the gene regulation is taking place. You have polyform, you have triphonics, they recognize these cis-acting elements. Of course, these initial transcription factors, let's say big card and methylal genes, GAG genes, once they came, they disappear, and the expression pattern, whether the gene has to be on or off, this is maintained by these proteins. There are multiple complexes. So for example, in polyform, there are proteins are called PRC1 complex, PRC2. So this complex of proteins, it causes histone H3 lysine 27 methylation. The PRC1, there is a protein called polyform. It recognizes methylated histone H3 at lysine 27, and it maintains that gene in silent state. Contrary, you have triphonics two proteins, and they are chromatin remodelers, they are histone acetyl transferases, so, or histone H3 lysine 4 methylation. So now you see, polyform group, it causes lysine 27 methylation and leads to gene silencing. Triphonics group, which are anti-silencers or gene activators, they cause lysine 4 methylation and maintain genes in silent state. Interesting thing is, both are the lysines. What is basically polyform and triphonics group error? This is important when I'm coming to the data, when I will start showing you the data. So if you have wild type, so this is how the classically these polyform and triphonics group proteins were also categorized. In wild type males of Drosophila, these structures are called sex cones. So these sex cones are only present on the first pair of legs in the males. They are missing on second and third. What happens in polyform, you get this phenotype. This is due to genetic mutation. You get this phenotype in case of, so ectopic, we call it on second and third, strong sex cone. To prove that trichorex antagonizes the polyform function, if you bring polyform and trichorex, you cross them together and bring them together in one organism, you reverse the phenotype back to normal. So what is happening here? Basically, due to loss of polyform, and polyform is mutant, genes are getting activated because polyform maintains genes in silent state here. So due to loss of polyform, you have genes which will lead to development of these extra sex cones, and these are getting active by trichorex group. Now, if you bring trichorex mutation together with polyform mutation, you will revert it back because trichorex is also bone, which was responsible for activating. Okay, let's come to the data, what I could generate. So we had a transgenic line, Drosophila transgenic line, which had a PRE, perhaps, I mean, this is the cis-acting element which is recognized by polyform and the trichorex group. This transgene could silence a mini-mite. Mini-mite is the gene which is responsible for giving this red eyes in the flies. So wherever you have red color, it means this gene is active. Wherever you have white, it means this gene is inactive. Because this PRE is somehow functional and polyform and trichorex are getting active here. So the observation was that this polyform and trichorex group mediated, you know, silencing is sensitive to temperature. This is like a phenotypic plasticity. You move at 18, from 18 to 29, this gene gets silent. You move back 29 to 18, and they get active. The gene gets active. Also, the observation I could generate was that at polyform, at 18 degree, if you have these flies, these sex cones disappear. If you bring back the polyform mutant to 25 or 29, 25 is the normal temperature, you get these sex cones again in the same same population. So these are the two things which gave me an idea that polyform and trichorex, they do respond to environment. They do behave, they do have a phenotypic switch, which is we refer to as phenotypic plasticity, and I got connected to, you know, finding HSP90 link with polyform trichorex. This is how the whole story initiated. So what we did as a geneticist, you always first like to do, instead of biochemistry, you first like to do genetic cross. So what we did, we used these lines, we brought HSP90 mutation in. Bringing HSP90, before I go there, I have to prove that this red color is due to trichorex group, because trichorex is maintaining it in an active state. this is a parent line. If I bring with the parent line, I cross this line with some of the trichorex group mutants. You see here, this is the eye color is getting lost. These two. This was not working. This is the trichorex line. So this showed that the reporter system, this is a very well established reporter. Renato published it itself in 1998, I believe. And I could show reproduce that this is responding to trichorex. What next I did was I crossed this line, our FLW line, with HSP90. So this was the trichorex group effect. If I cross with HSP90 alleles or HSP90 mutants, you see there are, so this is the parent line. If I have this line crossed with HSP90, you see that eye color is gone. It means this is mimicking the trichorex group behavior. Gene activation is getting lost there. So if this gene is no more active, you don't develop eye color. Important point to mention here is we did not find it happening in all the 100% of the flies. Only 20% of the flies showed. This is similar to the type of data which, you know, Lindquist and Rudel were finding, that only a small proportion or population of the flies show such phenotype. Another thing, if you recall this, this trichorex group mutant, this was not affecting at all at its own, the eye color. But if you combine it together with this, with the HSP90, you start seeing loss of function. So it means HSP90 is somehow interacting with the trichorex group proteins.
Sorry, just a point of clarification. So what is happening? Is the HSP90 dose being reduced by half?
Yeah, 50%, because my copy is. So HSP90 dose is getting reduced by 50% when I say genetic cause. Pardon? They do have phenotype. Yes, they do have phenotype.
Yeah. What is the
system? Very good question. This is a slide. Genius people are always ahead one slide. So this is the sex home pattern, you see. So this is -1+2+3+4+, this is the severity of the sex comb phenotype, one, second leg or third leg. And this, the gray bars, these are polycomb mutant alone. When polycomb mutant is just crossed, outcrossed with a wild type, you know. There's no HSP90 mutation here. So you see the gray bars, they are like showing very strong extra sex comb phenotype when polycomb mutation is alone. But when you combine polycomb mutation together with HSP90 mutation, these white bars, these are now coming back to normal. So this means HSP90 is suppressing the extra sex comb phenotype. It is behaving like trichorex group like mutation. We did it at two different temperatures, and if you see, at 29, this effect was even very drastic. So at 29, the suppression of sex comb was even more stronger, which I already told you that the sex comb phenotype is already responding to temperatures. So these two evidences, so our transgene assay, extra sex comb analysis, this is a classical genetic analysis, and based on this you can say HSP90 mutation has a trichorex group line behavior. But we had to go then molecular. You can't just be happy having some genetic evidence. So what we did, using genetic tricks, so this is a Drosophila larvae, and these are different precursor tissues in fly, we call them imaginal discs. So like for example, this is going to make wing, this is going to make leg, these are going to make heartbeat. So these are very well established. These are normally present in third instar larvae, you know, the crawling larvae. And here in the heartbeat, this is a small appendage behind the wing. So there is a very well established gene, which is the homeotic gene, ultrabithorax, people who work with homeodominant proteins or homeobox proteins. So this gene is active uniformly in this tissue. This is a control experiment. What we wanted to do, because as Vidhi already pointed out, we can only, through genetic crossing, we can only reduce the HSP90 dose by 50%. If you reduce 100%, flies are dead. So we call somatic clones is a trick in which you can, in a later stage, at larval stage, you can reduce in specific cells using specific tricks 100% of the protein function. So by doing this, so wherever you see GFP is missing, this is the clone or clonal population of the cells which lack 100% of the GFP, 100% of the HSP90. But the cells where you have GFP intact, it means these are either normal or contains two copies of HSP90 or half. So when we stained the ultraviolet antibodies, the same disk, you can see normally it is uniformly expressed, but what you could see here clearly that in specific regions we could see loss of UBX expression, ultraviolet. Why I chose the ultraviolet? Because ultraviolet is basically the classic target of triphorex group genes. So if you lack triphorex group here, you will see same thing. So you will lose the gene expression of the ultraviolet. So I'm there generating loss of function, I'm depleting HSP90, and I'm seeing the effect which I would see with the triphorex group function.
Tariq, are the cells actually there?
Yeah. I mean, I had a slide. Oh, I don't. Cells are there. I had DAPI. I had for the same reason, I had a second. No.
And is the growth normal?
Yeah, they grow normally. Sometimes you do see leg specific phenotype, like a one leg. It's not one leg. Leg, you know, has like two legs developed. Or sometimes you see heart is completely open.
What I mean is, the cell division normal?
Cell division normal. I would assume cell the clones were smaller and smaller. So if I do this experiment, I don't want to go detail. If I do this experiment, normally we induce clones after 48 hours. In this case, I had to go after 72 hours because if I do 48 hours, they are, you know, gone. They lose combination because the other cells which contain HSP90, they replicate.
So they behave like minute clones in some way?
More or less, you can say, but you have to be really very precise what time. I chose 72 hours.
Is the size of the disk itself smaller?
Yeah, the heartbeat disk is smaller.
No, yeah. So the mutated one, the size of the disk is smaller. Total number of cells is less.
No, actually, so Vidya is pointing out very rightly. I could find very few disks which had the clone. So either sometimes in the adults, I saw that the Haltia was completely gone, which means that due to more clones in the HSP90, division did not take place, and the tissue simply went away. But these were a very small number of lines, which showed me this phenotype. But otherwise, there was no effect on the size of the disc.
The total number of cells in the disc in HSP?
I did not count that. So this is another thing, you know, just for duplication, another test showing you in the heart here, you have uniform expression of the UBX, but you do this. It's very important to point out, just like the eye color phenotype or the Lindquist data of 2-3% fly showing this phenotype, this was really a small number of tests we could get, where we could see this. Reasons could be same what these two colleagues are pointing out, that either the disks are gone or clones are missing because HSP90 is involved in DNA replication as well. So far we had the genetic evidence here.
So you still have some time.
So after the genetic evidence, I could show you that HSP90 is basically interacting with polycomb and triphorex group proteins. And this is still referred to as genetic evidence, although I mean this is cytological. But together with the initial data and the transgene, this was a very strong evidence which showed that we have something to do with the triphorex proteins. We started focusing on triphorex protein, and an obvious experiment which came to my mind was take all the triphorex group antibodies, take Drosophila cells, inhibit HSP90 function, and start doing, you know, Western blot to see if any of the triphorex protein is getting affected, the stability is getting affected. What I could see that just within 2-4 hours, because I did not want to have, you know, secondary effects. So the experiment here is, you take now Drosophila cells in tissue culture, in cell culture. You grow them in the presence of DMSO and verdicil. Verdicil is a drug which specifically inhibits ATPase activity of the HSP9. And DMSO is the agent solvent in which the drug is solvent. So if you see here, within 2 to 4 hours, you have in verdicil treated cells, Prothorax is getting depleted. Prothorax is losing the total protein. However, another protein, which is part of the same complex, Prothorax interacts with a protein called CBP or Krebs binding protein. Its amount is not affected and tubulin. So this acts as a control for us, and this is showing that the Prothorax protein specifically gets affected. I did this with other proteins like Brahma, like Ashwan, other Prothorax group members. I could specifically see it in Prothorax. If you are losing in cell culture Prothorax group protein, and also you have genetic evidence that HSP90 behaves as Prothorax group protein in cell culture, an obvious experiment to ask is, what about the gene targets of Prothorax in cell culture, which are maintained in active state? They should show loss of expression. So a gene called B-form, this is one of the homeotic gene, a master regulator gene. I chose this. This is normally active in Drosophila cell culture. So in these Schneider cells, you see in, when you treat cells with DMSO alone, you isolate total RNA and you look at the expression of the deform, there is no effect. I mean, there is no effect on the Prothorax itself. There is no effect on the tubulin, which we used as a control. And however, deform is specifically reduced when you have inhibition of the HSP90 by the drug. This is the quantification of the, this downregulation or loss of deform expression. So, together, depletion of the Prothorax protein due to inhibition of the Prothorax, the loss of the deformed expression, it all, you know, consolidates all what we saw genetically. However, where all this interaction is taking place, whether it's happening at the in cytoplasm, because HSP90 is known to be a chaperone, whether it's catching up Prothorax in cytoplasm. So I just, like, my idea was, because HSP90 was not known, except in one case, that it may go on nucleus, onto chromatin. So I thought HSP90 may bind to Prothorax on chromatin. This was just a working model I generated for myself. Another possibility is HSP90 interacts with Prothorax in the nucleoplasm, and then Prothorax goes alone to do the job. HSP90 does not go on to the chromatin. You see here another protein, labeled X, which I'm working on. I hope some other time I will bring this talk as well. So, another hypothesis was HSP90 does not interact directly with this. HSP90 interacts with X, and X basically interacts or affects the chromatin, which is like this. So X is interacting with Prothorax maybe. All this can be happening in cytoplasm because HSP90 is a cytoplasmic protein. It was only once shown in 80s or 85 to electron micrograph that some, you know, gold particles they could see in the nucleus, but it was not a problem. Another very indirect part can be HSP90 has nothing to do with direct interaction with the Prothorax. It, because there are a number of kinases, there are a number of signal transduction proteins which are client proteins of the HSP90. It may be interacting with the kinase. Kinase is basically involved in post-translational modification of the Prothorax, and then this modified Prothorax go and does its job. In order to solve this puzzle, what I did, another, this is my favorite hypothesis, this is another story. So this is a conformational switch. This is like what we assume, because in yeast, the heat shock proteins or chaperones, they do have a role in epigenetic switch, which is caused by prions. If some of you are following Lindquist stories, where prion have protein-only hypothesis going to, you know, cytoplasm only. So what we thought that HSP90 may be involved in Prothorax conformational switch. It, you know, I'm hesitant to say prion-like, but let's say a conformational switch in Prothorax. That's an antibody which was working in Drosophila. So I generated two antibodies, but before antibodies were getting generated, I generated HSP90 fused to EGFP, and many viruses are reported gene, you know, we are making a transgenic line under its own promoter. Now, a transgenic line, because I would like to use GFP tag in the absence of antibody to see where HSP90 is going. Before you have to do your molecular analysis, you have to prove that your transgene is doing wild-type function. It's, we call it complementation. And I mean, you don't need to go through this crossing. Just trust me, this transgenic line, it complemented, it performed like wild-type HSP90. So these are the HSP90 transgenic flies. You see HSP tag with GFP, and this is the endogenous HSP90. These are the antibodies that are generated for HSP90, very, very specific antibodies. And this is the tubulin. So then came the functional data. What we did, we took fly salivary glands. These are the tissues in flies which contain giant chromosomes, the pollinating chromosomes. What we did, we took salivary glands and we just went under confocal microscope and we tried to see where HSP90 is without fixing, so that we did not want to have any artifacts due to formaldehyde or glutaraldehyde fixation. So this blue is the Duffy staining. You see, this is the nucleus. This is all around the cytoplasm, and now you see there is a very clear, these are two different confocal planes, and repeatedly we could see this HSP90 really, you know, uniformly distributed in nucleus. These cells are, of course, they contain giant chromosomes. These are one of the best tricks Drosophila have, and we did polyenes. So using HSP90 antibody, what we could see that there are some sites, not too much, but there are some sites on which HSP90 is coming. There are not too many, but an important observation here I could make was, so normally these darkly stained regions, these are heterochromatin, these are silent regions. I could see HSP90 in the regions which we call interband regions, which means these are active regions, interband regions are active. So this was just an observation. Next, what I did was, I used some polyenes, and I tried to look if HSP90 and triphorics are coming together onto the same site. There was a very limited overlap. So this is a HSP90 stain, triphorics, just focus on this one. Wherever you have these arrows, these are overlaps, but it could be that HSP90s may be all around chromatin, but amount is very low, which is below our detection limit. And there is an excellent story from Ritwik's student who replaced me in Renato's lab. It's published in Cell that HSP90 is on 8,000 loci. It's not my story, it's Ritwik's wonderful story. He took up this whole lot of kind of that. So, coming back to the phenotypic clusters. Coming back, if HSP90 and triphorics, you know, behave or come across each other at specific loci in different environment, in Drosophila we get heat shock. So all this, the previous slide was non-heat shock, without heat shock. What we did, we heat shock the Drosophila larvae, and then we did the same experiment, staining with triphorics and HSP90 to see if we can see some loci where they both come together intense. And here you can see these are called heat shock puffs. These are the regions where the HSP83, HSP90, HSP70, these are the heat shock proteins. Because at a heat shock, cell tries to activate a lot of heat shock proteins to keep to avoid the protein aggregation. So these loci, which get highly active, you see HSP90 and triphorics, they both come on heat shock puffs together. And a heat shock stress. So this is just a blow up of the same table. So these are the heat shock puffs. You can see, and if you quantify, so without heat shock, there is a very limited overlap, HSP plus triphorics, but when you heat shock, this overlap, which is detectable to us, it increases. This was using endogenous HSP90, so as a molecular biologist, the reviewers always ask you, okay, show me endogenous if you're using transgenic as well. So we did the same experiment using HSP-EGFP, and we could see on the heat shock puffs, you know, these are specific regions labeled cytologically, 93D, ATC, 87DC. they are labeled with a HSP shield.
So next step, what we did was we did chromatin IP because we had some evidence that HSP90 is coming onto chromatin. So we wanted to see HSP if HSP90 is sharing some of the sites where trithorax is also coming up. So this is a technique where you can specifically pull down the chromatin. So if you remember inhibiting HSP90 through radicchio, we could show on different PREs, these are the cis-acting elements, that trithorax was getting depleted under radicchio. Whenever you inhibit HSP90, trithorax protein was going away, but the polycomb was not getting affected. This is just a quantification of the gel. What we did next was, so this was like a experiment which correlated with what we saw, loss of deformed expression, loss of gene expression in KC cells. This correlated well with that. What we wanted to see, if in normal wild type case, some of the homeotic genes like ABDD gene, so this is active in the specific cell line, which is called SF4. This is 80 kilobase long region. We just used specific primers, and we could show that wherever there was a trithorax, HSP90 was also correlated, and HSP90 was also bounded. And through CoIP, this was a very difficult experiment because HSP90 is 300 plus kilodalton protein, and it gets proteolytically cleaved as well. So we could show, pull it down with HSP90 antibody and the Western blot with trithorax and vice versa, we could show they do interact biochemically with each other. So HSP90 linked to trithorax. So this is like one of the pieces I'm adding to the puzzle, so like, which may explain the epigenetic capacitor function, which Rudin's lab was hypothesizing that within one generation, you may fix a phenotype. You may not go through a number of generations to assimilate. So for example, now you have isogenic line, and due to stress, HSP90 impacts the trithorax. Trithorax, we know, is basically involved in gene activation, gene regulation through epigenetics. So you just have a stress. Now, the effect of the stress is transmitted at the level of chromatin. Chromatin modifications are changed. Now the rest of mitotic inheritance becomes independent of the trithorax. This is just a hypothesis. That's why I had a question mark in my title. So this may enhance the process of evolution. This may enhance process of, you know, the canalization. You can also use it as, they call it epigenetic capacitor, epigenetic progenitor model for cancer. You can think of it, you have an isogenic tissue, and then just due to slight stress, you are changing something at the epigenetic level and leading to disease. Let's end up at what Waddington did. This was another experiment. So this is a classic bithorax phenotype. This is a classic four-wing fly, which you generate when you have a mutation in trithorax or polycomb fly. Waddington generated these, and this is in his paper published in Evolution in 1956, just by giving acetone vapors to embryo, 2 to 3 hours old embryo, just for 25 minutes, not more than, and then going up to 25 generations, he repeated it. After 25 generations, the phenotype got canalized, fixed. And, I mean, this is not what Engel's picture, this is just I got from another paper. So you develop these four wings. So what I'm showing you, the link between HSP90 and trithorax, that could be what Engel saw in 50s, although he related all this to the genetic variation, but I would say maybe, and definitely now, we agree that there is epigenetic variation in the genome. And that epigenetic variation got expressed, and you had four-winged flies. This was the lab I was working in. This is Renato. I'm grateful to him. I mean, giving me a very free hand, because when I joined his lab, after 6 months, he told me, good luck with the project, because this is not my cup of tea, you chose it. And I'm grateful to Evo. I mean, they funded my research. Part of this research was done during my postdoc time in Center for Molecular Biology Heidelberg, and I moved to ETH together with Zurich, together with Renato. In 2009, I moved back to Pakistan, which is here, and just few four slides more, because doing all this, I thought I have learned enough. This is not the case. I didn't learn enough. I'm still learning today. But I thought I have learned, and I should go back from where I came, and I should deliver whatever. I should transfer the knowledge. In our region, it's very difficult because there's no funding, and you know there are no environment. Luckily, this is the first private molecular biology institute. Not only molecular biology. This is like a school of science and engineering. There are six floors. It comes with the Lahore University of Management Sciences. It's a 25 years old university. You know, spread around 100 hectares. They built this school in 2008. The first batch, you have met my two students, which are graduating. These are the first two students. There are six disciplines, and the philosophy is no boundaries philosophy. So you have on computer science, physics, electrical engineering, biology, and chemistry on six different floors. And the whole thing, and I think you can recognize in India, these two colleagues, Obed Siddiqui and Ashok Mittal, they are part of our advisory board together with, you know, a number of people spread around the world. They were the ones who initiated the whole vision in 2006. Their first class entered in 2008, and the rest of the stories these students can tell you, that when they were sitting in the class, they could always hear, you know, tha, tu, ti, because the construction work was still going on. And when even I joined, when I went to the institute, before joining, at the time of interview, I went with my mother, and the floor where I was supposed to be, it was, you know, water due to, you know, construction. And my mother said, are you crazy, you're coming back here? But I tell you, this is the fellow, Shahid Khan. He was the founding chair of biology. He initiated this. He did a lot of hard work. And I joined him in 2009, a year later, when the first batch entered. And he told me, don't think of only establishing your own group. And they were, he was together with vice chancellor, and they said, you have to establish a department. And that gave me, you know, literally my legs started shaking, because I came back to do what I wanted to do. So they gave me two targets, recruit faculty, and by 2012, you have to launch the graduate program. So because this school has undergrad program, BS, and I think our strength is faculty, and our strength is curriculum, I'll just show you. So I could convince all these people from 2009 onwards, and these people together designed the vision of the department, that we have molecular biology, our strength, we focus on computational biology, and together, in 10 years from now, inshallah, we will be giving you students which will be excellent doing systems biology. As I said, we have BS in cell and molecular biology at the moment. Computational biology by bioinformatics is a very important part of cell and molecular biology. And this fall, so the milestone we were given in 2009, we are launching the PhD in cell and molecular biology. Just a short intro. So Aziz is coming back from UK. He will be computational biology. He has established his lab in computational biology. Hassan is a microbiology from Imperial College. He is establishing lab in, you know, heavy metal resistance in microbes. Zakir Ola, he just joined 2 months ago. I could convince him to lead 17 years of life in USA. He was working at NIH, and he works on trophectoderm stem cells. Cell cycle in trophectoderm stem cells. Kamran is another computational biologist. As I told you, we have a major focus in computational biology. He worked at York, and he designed structure-based drug design. This is his expertise. Saima is a very talented, our own PhD from Pakistan. I think in Pakistan, it's not that she's working with me. She's one of the best young human geneticists, an excellent scientist. And I would say without her, I couldn't be standing here, because she was one of the big help in teaching and establishing labs and all these things. Jabbar, I could convince, because being an agricultural country, you can't, you know, ignore plants. So he's at Ohio State Columbus. He'll be joining inshallah this fall. His expertise is disease resistance in Arabidopsis he's working. So here, he's our dean, and now, when he joined, he was just a faculty with me. So he works on gene regulation in extreme mobile. So everybody who is coming, it's a very North American model, where you are independent PI, you're given a startup, and you reduces, and I myself do already have. So basically I said our strength is curriculum. Strength is curriculum because I think it's more like IITs and the North American. So in the freshman year, in the first year, we push them to Cal 1, Cal 2, classical physics, mechanics, E&M, biology, chemistry, computer science. So regardless of whatever major subsequently they're going to choose, they have to go through all these courses. We call it core courses. Just imagine a biologist has to go through these differential equation linear algebra, Cal 1, Cal 2, even in the fifth semester, probability and statistics. The reason is we want them to be ready 10 years from now because the pace of biology is changing. And what we have achieved in the last 4 years is these five, I mean, we had 14 students, 7 of them have already got a placement. I mean, she's going to Harvard neuroscience program, he's going to University of Chicago, she's going to UIUC, she is going to Dartmouth, and Rehan is going to Vermont. There are two more news to us. And these are, this is a paradigm shift I call in Pakistan. When I went for PhD, people asked me, you have to have masters. If you go to USA, you have to first do masters and then go to PhD. All these students, what we could generate, they all have fully funded direct PhD after BS. And what we were told, and I'm really proud and thankful to all the faculty, I'm especially grateful to, I should remember Shahid, so that we could generate a curriculum in less than 4 years, we could generate, you know, population of students in a country which is not portrayed in the media to generate mass scale terrorists. So we can show you we have real good brain as well who's working there. And I think these are the, this is the generation which is going to bring change. Thank you very much for your patience.
It seems to me that if that's the only thing happening, how do you explain all kinds of epigenetic, you know, variation and further mutation?
I can only explain the trithorax-mediated epigenetic variation. I'm not saying HSP90 only binds to trithorax. What I'm doing is more like a direct approach. If you read Ritwik's paper from Cell, you will see it's involved in RNA pausing, RNA call to pausing. It shares all the binding sites where trithorax is bound, but it also is bound with, together with RNA call 2, there is a factor which is pausing RNA call 2 before, you know, it initiates the transcription. So if I limit HSP90 only with trithorax, that would be doing injustice. But I could show that this is one piece of the bigger puzzle. So, and HSP90 is also not the only hub or only canalization factor. I trust there will be many more canalization factors.
Does HSP90 bind with the trithorax protein and
chromatin?
Pardon?
Can you repeat it, please?
Does HSP90?
No, please speak into the mic.
Yeah, I hear.
Okay, does HSP90 bind with trithorax protein on the chromatin? So I'm referring your cheap experiment.
Yeah, so of course, I could show direct biochemical interaction. Not direct, indirect, because I use a whole cell lysate. Whether it's directly binding with trithorax onto chromatin or via an intermediate, I mean, my data doesn't.
Have you performed double
chip? But it does bind to chromatin. HSP90 does bind to chromatin. That's true.
And one more question regarding your localization study. You have shown that HSP90 is present on the chromatin. So have you seen co-localization with methyl CpG antibody?
Okay, in Drosophila, unfortunately, there is no DNA methylation. I love to have DNA methylation because I'm losing one of the epigenetic markers. So there's no DNA methylation in Drosophila.
And about histone modification?
Yeah, it should be going together with histone H3 lysine 4. The paper I'm again, I mean, I don't want to because it's straight fixed data, but it's published now. It will go together with histone H3 lysine 4. Because there's a very nice study, a huge amount of data in Cell.
Okay.
I was a bit puzzled about these isogenic lines in which you seem to get not only a heritable change in cellular phenotype, but also I thought you implied a heritable change in organismal phenotype. I didn't quite get that. These were the experiments of someone you had mentioned, Ruddle or
Ruddle.
Yes, yes.
Yeah.
So what was your explanation for that?
So what Ruddle did was he took the same flies which he used to mutationize first. So what he did, he mutationized HSP90, like reduced the 50% of HSP90 dose. He could see this phenotype. He selected them. And after F1...
No, but one sec. Were the flies isogenic really to begin with?
Yeah, he did this crossing. He did repeated back crossing, I think, for 8 generations or 20 generations. I can't exactly say. I mean, the number of generations which in classical genetics, they say, you need to do this much generation to ensure they are isogenic.
And then carried out phenotypic selection.
Yeah, he did phenotypic selection. So, interesting thing is that you just get that slide, it becomes more easy. Yeah. So what he did was, this fly line, when he saw this phenotype, he repeatedly back-crossed with a wild type and isogenized them. What he realized that this mutation, HSP90, has to come from mother. It has to have a maternal effect. If it comes from father, it was not giving that strong phenotype. So it, number one thing, it has to come from mother. Number two, it just needs to be there in mother. In subsequent generations, you can outcross it. Am I clear?
That's clear. I thought Rutherford and Lindquist had shown that too, that you could get rid of the...
Not in one generation. So Rutherford and Lindquist, they had to select for phenotype and genotype of mutation, and they could see only after some generations where, which was with these arrows, you know, this was repeated selection. In here, what he could show was that and he did not only with the genetic mutation, with the HSP90 mutant, he used the same fly line and used gentamicin, which is an inhibitor of HSP90. And he could show that you need to inhibit only one generation. In subsequent generation, you have a phenotype.
Yeah, that's the bit that puzzles me. How do you get stable transmission of the phenotype if your background is really isogenic?
Yeah, the reason is that in the mother, or the first generation of parents, when you feed gentamicin, you inhibit the HSP90 function. So due to inhibition of the HSP90 function, you have now something changed at the epigenetic level. Now, that becomes independent of the HSP90, because epigenetic maintenance of epigenetic marks, just like I showed example of DNA methyl transferases, because these are maintained through DNA replication.
That's clear, but it is also maintained through organismal generation?
Yeah, this is that was the beauty of this study. So this was transgeneration. Just one generation was fed with gentamicin, and next 14 generations was showing this phenotype. This was a transgeneration.
But I'm just imagining what could have been the mechanism, because during...
One sec, can you get a microphone?
Because during spermatogenesis and oogenesis, the cell undergoes lots of changes, and that time how these marks are maintained.
So how epigenetic marks are made?
Yes.
So these marks are heritable. Like there is a very nice study.
And because you shut off all the protein synthesis and active translation and all that.
You set off what?
You shut off active protein synthesis.
Mm-hmm. No, but these marks are certainly inherited. There is a very nice study which they did at the 2-cell stage in Drosophila. So when the fertilization is taking place, they could show that the paternal and the maternal epigenetic marks, which were histone H3 lysine 27 and histone H3 lysine 4, they are very well conserved there. So during the spermatogenesis and oogenesis, there are very stringent mechanisms which ensure that these marks on very, very specific loci, they are not erased, because, you know, anything which goes wrong in spermatogenesis, the organism is going to die. So during evolution, the stringency of the mechanism is very, very high. So HSP90, even in spermatogenesis, is very important. It inhibits the transposons in the Drosophila genome. So if you remove HSP90 during spermatogenesis in the sperms, what you see, you have all the long crystal-like phenotype. And this is due to the genes called stellate or stella. These are the transposons which get activated.
This is not quite related to your details of your talk, but you remember that Waddington was very clear that his ideas about genetic assimilation were not like the so-called Waldman effect.
And I
wondered whether you thought at all about, I mean, I don't like the word Waldman effect because actually Waldman and Lloyd Morgan and Osborne were preceded by Spaulding by 23 years. So he came up with the idea long before them. But anyway, whatever you call it, here you get an effect where the adaptability of the organism then leads to a point where by spontaneous mutation, then you get a phenotype and there are an evolutionary change. Now, in that second case, I mean, where you have adaptability, do you see any of the processes which you're seeing in this case of assimilation operating?
You mean some genetic mutations?
Yes.
No. So it's a very good question, and I actually wanted to talk about this, but I was rushing through. So the last slide I had this Baldwin effect.
Yes,
that was actually from Waddington's review I got, and he the point he should not. You know, Waddington said it's all due to genetic variation. But in his review, he talked about Baldwin effect. And Baldwin effect he referred to as, you know, some non-genetic variation, or people refer to it as organic variation, which Patrick is referring to. And I'm also a strong proponent of, you know, epigenetic modification coming first and then leading to some genetic modification. But I haven't yet found anything like this. To be honest and to tell you the truth, I am in a process of designing a project at the moment in this direction. But if anybody wants to collaborate, maybe we can collaborate. Because I'm a very strong proponent of, you know, environment or adaptability leading to epigenetic modifications. Let's say some gene loses its function at the level of epigenetics, and if it stays for consistently for some generations, it's like use or lose like thing. The cellular machinery would recognize that, okay, maybe we don't need it and we need to mute it. And then you get the genetic mutation.
Yeah.
I haven't done it, but I'm in a process of doing such a study. Good. Thank you very much.
Mike, just wanted to add something. HSP story.
Can you use the mic?
Yeah, the HSP story is not that straightforward. Because more recently it is shown that inhibition of HSP, either by mutation or by inhibitors, is actually mutagenic.
It's a mutagen? HSP90
is mutagen. Yeah, no, the fact that you don't have HSP90 in the cell is mutagenic because it now turns on the transposon in the genome.
Yeah.
So some of the mutations that you see probably have a genetic alteration, they're not just mutagenic.
I entirely agree with you. So
this is shown by...
That's why, if you remember, in my title there was a question mark at the end. Because this is like a big Pandora box. Because if you're losing HSP90, you're affecting at least 100 client proteins. And those 100 client proteins, some of them definitely contain, you know, signaling kinases which feed into DNA damage repair or, you know, homologous recombination. If those are being affected, you're definitely going to have some genetic effect.
Ritwik wrote a nice review.
Who?
Ritwik.
Yeah, that was, I think, in developmental cell or? No.
General Biosciences.
Okay.
In the last slide you showed about bithoracic Drosophila, was it actually having two thorax or was it the hunters which got modified into wings?
So may I repeat the question? So your question is the fly with four wings, if it has two thorax or, so it has bithorax means two thorax.
Or was it, did it have four halters also?
They had four wings.
Yeah.
Because the halter is transformed into a wing.
Halter is transformed. So it was only a single thorax, but the halters were transformed into.
No, you do get bithorax, like double thorax as well.